Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I'm the dull Bob Hill.
Why are you so dull, Bob Hill?
I'm just kidding. We got a colorful show today.
We do have a colorful show today, literally and figuratively.
Yeah.
Exciting. Two really good topics. Bob Gutowski from the Morse Arboretum is going to talk about different iris species.
He's a very excitable guy, and he loves iris, and he really tells a good tale about how to grow iris, where to grow iris, when to grow iris, and most important,
what's the difference?
You can have a whole parade of iris, which you don't think about, from March all the way through midsummer, then they rebloom in the fall.
There's some reblooming iris now.
Yeah.
Crazy. Actually, we have some of those.
I do, too.
But I think for a long time, there was only like one or two, and now there's more.
They're all grandmas.
So that's exciting.
Yeah.
And then a local, shall we say...
Landlord
is joining us.
Yeah.
Larry Mulcher is a Purple Martin landlord, as he likes to call himself, and others that house martins during the season. It's fascinating, exciting topic. Purple martins have long sort of captured people's imagination. And Larry's been, you know, he grew up around it, but he's been doing it as an adult for about a decade now. So he's got some really good information on how to attract purple martins, keep them happy, healthy, and to encourage the children coming back every year to your houses.
Yeah, Larry's one of those guys that you're glad you get up in the morning because you meet somebody like that.
Yeah.
They're just fun to talk to. Here's a guy works at the Ford plant, and he created a purple martin heaven at the Ford plant and at his house and at Bernheim. He just loves the birds, and he just does it because he loves the birds.
Exactly. It's as simple as that, really. Yeah.
And what a wonderful man he is.
Yeah. So we're definitely looking forward to learning more about purple martins and iris. So stick with us today on Homegrown. Bob, what's going on in your garden?
Well, I'm in the color mode there, too. We talk about tree peonies every year at spring, and I encourage people to try tree peonies. Mine are putting out those wonderful, bright, vivid red tips. Tree peonies are so neat.
Yeah.
They're goddesses in themselves. They actually grow in a shrub or a tree in time. And
they're woody.
Yeah, they're not herbaceous like the others. My gold tip conifers, I'm a complete sucker for gold tip conifers.
Because now's the time you really see that pure gold tip early growth, right? The new growth.
And then my viburnums are starting to bud out and the fragrance to follow. So tree peonies, gold tip conifers, viburnums coming out. Spring is going to get here. Finally.
Yes, finally.
How about the Wish Estate? What's up?
My cardoon.
Cardoon, that's a country in the Mideast, isn't it?
No.
Oh.
You grow cardoon too. It came back.
It did?
Can you believe it?
I'm envious.
So listen, this is why I think it came back.
Okay.
Okay, cardoon is, actually it's something that you can eat. Italian recipes, you know, sometimes have it.
Yeah.
It's sort of like how you would eat rhubarb. You don't eat the foliage, leafy part, but you eat the stalk part.
The camels like it too.
Yeah, and like some of them have spines on them, so you have to take the spines off and like you blanch them. Anyway.
It's a funky plant.
It is a funky plant. I don't really know how to eat it, so I just grow it because it's really cool looking. Really large, silvery green foliage that's very cut out, sort of like artichoke, right?
Yeah, but 3 or 4 feet across.
But really big. Yeah. Okay. So I'm excited that they came back because guess what? They're going to be really big this year.
I got to check mine.
Plus, I bet you I'll get them to bloom this year since they're already starting to grow. Where last year we started them from seed and they didn't even make it into the garden until, you know, later. Anyway, they came back because of this. I never cleaned up the patch. So all of that foliage that died back stayed on top of the plants as mulch all winter long.
You preach to us all winter about the importance of...
Only if you have disease or disease problems.
Oh, okay.
I ain't got no disease problem in my cardoon patch.
Apparently not.
So, I honestly, it's like all that huge, like you said, this huge foliage, it dried out, actually, so it wasn't all mushy and yucco.
Right.
And it created this nice blanket, this crust, over top, literally, over top of the plants, thus insulating them from the cold. Because they're marginally hardy, depending on, you know.
Yeah.
But that has to be why. So I pull all that stuff off, right? Cut it back. And, like, the cores are so big, you couldn't really cut any more back. So then all of a sudden, like a week or so ago, I looked down and I'm like, oh! They're coming back from their roots.
Cardoons in Simpsonville.
So it'll be pretty cool to see if I do get bloom.
You have a cardoon character there.
Yeah, it'll be nice.
You do.
I'll keep you posted.
You just put a picture on the web is what you're going to do.
Of course I will.
The world's got to see that.
That's right. All right, Bob, there's some things going on around town. What do you got?
Actually, more proof that time flies when you're having fun. Farmington's 45th annual plant sale. It's a good one, folks.
It's a good plant sale.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Saturday, April 19th from 9 a.m. until 3 p.m. This year's kind of fun. They've moved it from the Visitor Center parking lot into that really cool historic garden designed by Ann Bruce Haldeman. She's a famous landscape architect from yore, so.
We've talked about.
Yeah, vegetables, herbs, annuals, perennials, just really neat stuff. And Matt Gardner will speak on putting the green back in the gardening, and there'll be pony rides for the kids.
Excellent.
April 19th at Farmington.
All right. A couple of other things. Bob, did you know that Tuesday, April 22nd was Earth Day?
Every day is Earth Day to me, kid.
Well, I hope so. Yeah. I'm not so sure about that always. I don't know how your recycling's been lately. But yes, it's Earth Day, and in conjunction with Earth Day, there's loads going on to be sure. April 19th and 20th is the Spring Fling at Country Corner Greenhouse. Country Corner Greenhouse has been around a long time.
We've been there.
They're in Shepherdsville off of I-64, Highway 44 exit, basically. It's on your way to Mount Washington. Between Shepherdsville and Mount Washington, you can't miss it. So they're having some special festivities on the 19th and 20th, container gardening class, as well as door prizes and snacks and stuff like that. So ringing in spring. With some festivities. Also, the Shelbyville Garden and Art Fair is going to take place Saturday, April 26th, 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. It's always held at the Shelby County Fairgrounds, that pavilion area there. Mm-hmm. So if you want to get some questions answered by the Shelby County Master Gardeners, do a little shopping, you know, there's arts, food, etc. It's a pretty nice event. I often head out there myself. So April 26, 9 to 2. And of course, if you've got any events that are garden related, please let us know. You can visit our website, wfpl.org, click on Homegrown, email us your press release, that sort of thing, and we'll get it on the air and put it on the website if we can.
Among them will be the Louisville Area Iris Society meeting, I'm sure later on in the spring, sometime in May, I think.
But yeah, their show comes up, I think, later.
To get us ready for that, we're going to speak to a man who's an iris genius. His name is Bob Gutowski. He's director of public programs at the Morris Arboretum near Philadelphia, where they teach like 100 different classes a year, including one Bob teaches on iris. His personal arboretum garden includes more than 24 species and 250 named varieties, which can extend the iris season from March all the way through June, when the repeat bloomers will kick in again in the fall. And today, we'll learn how to create such a garden right here in Louisville. Bob, welcome to Homegrown.
Pleased to be here.
I've been driving people half nuts lately talking about the Morris Arboretum and what all the fine stuff they have there, and of course, a fine guy like you. But give us a little history about the Morris quickly, and we'll move on to iris from there, maybe.
Well, the Morris Arboretum, the University of Pennsylvania, we're celebrating our 75th anniversary this year as a university garden. But we started in 1888 as a private gardener, John and Lydia Morris, who always had the idea that this would become a public garden for people to visit, a place where research happened, and a place for collecting and displaying plants.
Mm-hmm. So is there a particular collection that's most notable at the Morris Arboretum?
Well, an arboretum is a collection of woody plants, so it's the trees and the shrubs. We're a national collection for the fir trees, the AB species.
All right.
Oh, yeah.
For our rhododendron, our witch hazel collection, just outstanding this year. We're a part of the national collection for oaks and magnolias, blooming very nicely at the moment. And, of course, the rose garden, I wouldn't call it a collection, but it is... It is unmatched in the world, I think, as a display garden.
That's a start.
There are plenty that are just as good, but I don't think you'll find any better.
All right.
And Bob, within all that wonderland, there's a place called Miller's Cottage, which happens to have a personal iris collection run by somebody we know. Tell us about Miller's Cottage.
Well, the Arboretum is on the National Register of Historic Places as a historic landscape. And this area was settled in the 1700s, and about 1763, the house I live in was built, and that was the Miller's house. And the mill is right outside the window on the creek, and the Miller's cottage has a garden that I've been working on for about 10 years.
So you live in the Miller's cottage?
Yes, isn't it a blessing?
No, you are one lucky duck.
It is a blessing. Keep the mosquitoes, keep the deer, but love being there.
Wow. Okay, so there's an iris collection there. Is it your personal collection, or is it considered part of the
Arboretum's
collection?
Well, it's not in the public part of the garden.
All right.
This is on the farm side, and so it's scheduled visits, but I teach classes there in cottage gardening, and I've been teaching an iris class. And then we'll have events where we give tours, particularly in May, throughout May and in June, where people will come over. I've got 250 labeled different kinds of iris. But for the most part, it's a private passion made public because, you know, you just got to share something that's so beautiful.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Well, let's talk some iris history, including how it got its wonderful name.
How it got the name iris?
Yeah.
Well, according to a legend, actually, I think this has never been decided. Which was named first, the goddess iris or the plant iris?
Mm-hmm.
Which is, you know, it's the rainbow flower, and there's all this discussion in Greece, but if you go far enough back in history, which I've done a couple of times to try to sort this out, and the literature will always say it's named after the goddess of the rainbow,
right?
Because of the colors of the rainbow. But the iris in Greece is purple or it's yellow.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's not all the
it's
colors
sort
of the rainbow, which
happened
somewhat later.
Uh-huh.
But it was the messenger. The rainbow was the way that the Olympians communicated with the earthlings, us mortals.
I see.
And so that rainbow eventually, as the religion developed and evolved, became associated with the goddess itself. So iris has long been associated with the goddess of the rainbow or with the rainbow.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about the leprechaun and the pot of gold, mate?
Well, yeah, that's another. Well, let's see what...
That came a little later, too, probably. So there are a great many different iris.
That's right.
And I think that's what can potentially confound people when they're growing them because they don't, you know, is it a corm? Is it a rhizome? You know, when do you dig and divide? How do you do so, et cetera? So can you give us a sense of how many different iris species actually exist and the nuances that make them each unique?
Sure. There are between 250 and 300 species of iris.
Uh-huh.
That's species.
Wow.
There have been over 60,000 named irises,
right.
Cultivars of irises.
Right.
And that's quite a big range. But generally speaking, what would people be growing in and around Louisville?
Right.
They'd be growing bearded irises, or they'd be growing beardless irises. And there's a couple of other groups, the bulbous, which are really hard to grow. The most popular one when people think of the fleur-de-lis are the, actually the fleur-de-lis is a beardless iris.
Mm-hmm.
That's the iris pseudocorus,
okay.
Which grows in across Europe and it's become naturalized across the rest of North America and much around the world. It's a yellow iris, grows in swampy areas, very easy to grow. Considered an invasive plant in many states because it's supplanted our native irises. The bearded irises are recognizable. They've got right in the middle. They've got this fuzzy caterpillar crawling down into the throat that the bees land on, bumblebees land on, and those are the bearded irises. Horticulturally, we break the bearded irises into groups that are a sequence of bloom and a height sequence. The shortest ones bloom first, earliest, and the tallest ones bloom latest. And they have funny little names. The miniature dwarf bearded iris. So, like, dwarf isn't enough. You have to be a miniature dwarf bearded iris. And that's under 8 inches. And they're great in the rock gardens. They have very the rhizome for that is maybe no bigger than your finger. It's a small plant.
Is that the cristata?
Well, cristata is a woodland iris, and that's another group, neither beardless nor bearded.
Oh, okay.
It is in between. It's got a ridge. It's got a kind of like a turkey wattle. down the middle of it, and that's a beautiful little plant, 6-8 inches.
Yeah.
Grows in the woods, kind of scrambles over the ground. It never really roots itself in.
Mm-hmm.
It just scrambles over the ground and then roots down through the leaf litter.
Mm-hmm.
The next group is the standard dwarf beardeds, and this is one of my favorite groups, and I think is really good for the home landscape, front of the border plant. These plants are basically, most of them are about 12 inches. None of them get taller than 17 inches, because if it's taller than that, they don't call it a dwarf. And they bloom very early on, just past the daffodils, right before the tulips are coming in. So they're a really good group. That's the second period to bloom. A lot of wonderful color ranges, everything from whites, yellows, pinks, blues, purples, bicolors, streaked flowers, even some getting very close to red, which is a very interesting development. And then there's the intermediate bearded, which is what got me started, because the German iris, that old-fashioned iris, which I think is it's in Tennessee is the state flower.
Is that like the flag?
Yeah, the blue flag, the old blue flag that everybody's grandma grew.
Sure.
Right.
This plant is an intermediate bearded, so that blooms way before the peonies. And it's about 17, 27 inches, wonderful, good plant. They've developed re-blooming. This is the exciting thing in a garden. That's a very nice height to work with in the garden at, you know, 17 to 27 inches, great height. And then to think that you can get them to bloom not just in early May, but you can have them bloom again in September and October. I had irises on my Thanksgiving table.
That's fabulous.
Last year with the pumpkins. You
but you know, Bob, one of the things that I've always liked about irises is that the foliage really does... You know, you can enjoy the bloom, but the foliage is such a fabulous feature in the garden. Those, you know, whether it's short or tall, those that vertical drama is so useful.
And right now, it looks great.
Uh-huh.
Because it's pushing, it's spring, it's pushing up. You've got a lot of color throughout. You've got that green, and there's a little variation in the greens, but it's all pushing up throughout the garden. It looks terrific. And then if you have the median, that smaller group of irises of standard dwarf bearded and intermediates, they're either smaller than the tall bearded irises, which is what everyone thinks about, the 3-4 foot plants.
Mm-hmm.
You get that variation in texture because the one is smaller, the one is larger. And with hellebores going on right now, you've got a wonderful combination of textures and colors, and the hellebores are taller than any of the irises right now in flower. So they're looking good. As they fade, those standard dwarf beardeds are going to come on. I agree with you. I think that, and there's a few variegated leaf. Now, the beardless irises, the Siberians
those
and the Louisiana irises and the Japanese irises, which all like a little moister. The bearded iris, you got to have drainage and more drainage and even more drainage in full sun. And then you have to have drainage, you know, for them to thrive.
Maybe that's why I like the beardless and the crested better.
Oh, yeah. They'll take a little moisture. They'll take a little shade. Like the Japanese roof iris, the Iris tectorum, is one of the most beautiful irises. That form alba looks like a white egret's taking off when that's blooming. That's a wonderful carpet. It takes a little shade, so it's very adaptable to smaller gardens, but it has more mass than the cristata, so you don't lose it. Very nice plant.
Wow. The iris seem very aggressive and need a lot of dividing. Is that true?
Well, the iris thrive on dividing, and I've come to think that they're the zucchini of the vegetable world. That once you start growing them and harvesting them, which you do in July to divide them or separate them, you end up with bushels of iris rhizomes and not enough friends to give them to. It's pretty amazing, but it's the whole life cycle of iris that makes it exciting. You mentioned the leaves, but that time of division when you begin to separate them, you know, see how they're structured and how they grow. And you only do that about every 3 or 4 years with the tall bearded.
Okay.
With the smaller, you never need to divide the cristatas. But the median irises, those dwarf bearded, standard dwarf beardeds, you only need to divide them about every 7 years. Mm-hmm. And you just say, I got to give them a patch about, you know, two or 3 feet of patch, mm-hmm. and they'll fill that up. The division is important because they love new soil, and they crowd out. And when they crowd themselves out, they don't throw up as many bloom stalks.
Right.
They just say, I'm going into a stay-alive mode, but I'm not going to waste anything on flowering.
Right.
And so you divide them up, and then you can, people say that 3 to 4 year clump is the most florific.
Well, Bob, thanks for your enthusiasm and your knowledge, and I think your iris are going to walk out here in a couple of years or so. So
thank you so much, Bob.
All right, thank you.
Bob Gutowski is Director of Public Programs at the Morris Arboretum near Philadelphia, and an iris lover from way back. For more information on Bob, the Arboretum, or the Louisville Area Iris Society, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org.
Coming up next, Larry Melcher and the Purple Martin. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I remain color-coded, Bob Hill.
Color-coded. How come color-coded?
Because we're moving on to purple.
Oh, after all the many colors of iris,
yes.
Now purple.
Hmm. Exactly.
Yes, the purple martin.
Stick with me, kid.
And I'm very excited to learn more about the purple martin because Daddy had houses up, and we would get them. And after reading through some of Larry Melcher's notes, our guest today, I realized some of the things we may have been doing wrong over the years as to why our purple martin population declined. I know you're interested in it.
Yeah, I failed miserably also, and I want to try again.
All right.
I've got the space. I've got the sky.
You've got the desire.
I don't have the birds yet.
That's right. So we'll find out how to actually attract them successfully. Larry Melcher is joining us today. He grew up around his father's interest in purple martins, but it wasn't until his work at the Ford Assembly Plant about the year 2000 that his own interest grew to some proportions. Larry manages, if you can call it that, 58 houses at his home, 36 at the Ford plant, and then 52 out at Bernheim as the volunteer that takes care of the colony out there. And of course, you can visit that one. Over the years, he certainly learned a lot, kind of self-taught about the purple martin, and he's here to explain what we can do actually to support purple martins and try to attract them to our own gardens. Larry, welcome to Homegrown. Thanks for joining
us. Thanks, Janine. Thank you. Great. Cool, Bob.
How you doing, man?
All right.
All right. What's the appeal for you ultimately, Larry? How'd you get hooked? I mean, you grew up around them, but you didn't get involved until a little bit later in life.
Yeah, Dad had them in the backyard when I was a kid. We were always familiar with having them around, and mm-hmm. they were fun. It's just something that completes summer to me. You know, it's Dad decided to give me the old house that he wasn't using no more, and mm-hmm. I put it up in the backyard, and luckily I got purple martins the very first year, and wow. since then I was hooked. And
A little success always gets you hooked when you start out on
something,
doesn't
it? That was a lucky one.
All right, so let's sort of talk about the purple martin in and of itself before we get into attracting. What do they look like exactly? Because I know sometimes in the spring, I look for them as well out at the farm, but we also have barn swallows and other types of swallow species. So I'm always sort of staring and looking and trying to figure out, is it purple martin? Is it a barn swallow? Is it a chimney swift? You know, what is it?
Right. They almost look black from a distance. If you look at them with binoculars, you begin to see the bluish purple tone to them, and mm-hmm. that's usually in the adult males that are totally black looking from a distance, but they're purple. But
so all black, no white colorations or anything on them?
Well, some of the females have light colored bellies.
Okay.
They might be a dark brown to a light, almost a white, but mm-hmm. more of a brown in it.
Okay, so the papas are the dark purple black.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, and they don't get that adult plumage until after they're 2 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Like babies that fly away from the nest and migrate to South America with their parents, when those babies come back, the males look like females.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they'll have mm-hmm. a few markings, so they're kind of hard to tell. But, you know, once the males become 2 years old, then they're totally dark.
Okay.
And And they pretty much look purple, but but don't expect a grape-colored bird.
It's sort of an iridescent purple in the sunlight, right?
Yeah,
wouldn't you say that? Is their song sort of specific? Can you
well,
determine that way?
Well, it's like any other bird. You know, you can definitely tell their song is
when
different.
When you know them.
Yeah, when you know them. But they have a real pleasant chirp. They even have like an alarm call.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever the hawk flies by or something, you know, they'll make a distinct call. But once you have them in your yard, you get to learn that they'll even have like a chatter that it seems like they're talking to each other. But they're real pleasant to have around the yard, not only because they look like acrobatic flyers, but it's their song. You know, it just completes the yard.
Yeah.
Larry, let's talk some about their social habits. How widespread are they in North America? And then the migration patterns, how does that work?
Well, the migration, they come to North America just to breed and raise young. And in this part of Kentucky, they usually get here mid to late March. Mine this year came March the 18th, and I had one female at first, and it's usually the oldest birds that return first.
Okay, so they're kind of the scouts,
yeah,
if you will. Okay.
Yeah, that scout term is, some people misunderstand it. They think that it's a scout that comes and looks and finds a colony and then goes back, and that's not what happened. It's usually just the oldest birds that return first, and they come back early just to reserve their nest site against starlings and sparrows and other nest cavity seeking birds.
How far do they fly? Where do they spend the rest of the year in South America?
Well, they pretty much go in Brazil. Now, I'm not real good in geography, but I know they go to South America, and it's in Brazil. Okay. They're all over in South America. There's different places that different groups, different banding studies have shown that some in certain parts of South America may end up in different parts of North America. And purple martins almost entirely depend on human-supplied nest sites east of the Rocky Mountains.
Huh.
Now, west of the Rocky Mountains, they're still looking for old woodpecker cavities and things like that.
So when do they usually head out? You said your first female showed up March 18th.
Uh-huh.
How long are they around? When do they go back south?
They usually head back south around last part of July. They'll leave my colony.
Okay.
And what they do, they form what they call pre-migratory roost. They'll go...
pick up everybody in the vicinity sort of thing?
Uh-huh. And they'll hang around in an area for a while. It's real interesting. Something else I learned, that these roosts actually show up on Doppler radar. In the mornings when they take off, they're like green donut rings on the radar.
It's not a thunderstorm. It's a migrating roost of purple martin.
It's utterly amazing to me that they go to Brazil and come back here and end up in the same little bird hole in Louisville, Kentucky. It just blows your mind how they do that.
Oh, it is.
So let's do talk about some of that. Some people may not realize that if everything goes well, they raise their family successfully, they will be inclined to come back to the exact location. So the purple martins that we may attract one year will then bring their children back, and then their children and their children, if the success in raising their young continues. How do we go about doing that? Do you know what I mean? We talked earlier in the segment, our struggles and trials and tribulations over the years of maintaining martins. What's the trick?
The best thing to do is just watch your birdhouse.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like a bluebird house. If anybody was to put up a bluebird house, you want to attract a bluebird to it.
Mm-hmm.
And you want to enjoy that house that you put up and just keep your eye on it. The best thing you can do is just watch your purple martin house. And
what are we watching for, Larry?
You're making sure that purple martins are attracted to it. And,
uh-huh.
You know, obviously. But there's starlings, European starlings, and English house sparrows are two non-native species that also try to get the martin houses from the, you know, the nest cavities from the purple martins. You know, you got to keep the starlings and the sparrows out.
Okay.
And they have special entrances that you can put on your martin housing. For the longest time, they used to use 2 1/8-inch diameter hole, and the martins like that, but they found out that the starlings can also get in there.
Okay, and you brought an example. He brought some gourds that he's made, and the traditional round hole, but then also a modified hole that has a little insert in it that kind of creates, if you will, a flattened out purple martin shape, right? Sort of like if it was a dime, you could slip the dime right into the hole, but it's the purple martin shape. So we'll show you images of that if you go to our website at WFPL.org. Just click on homegrown. But those are the sorts of things that I guess that are new technologies that make it a little bit easier. Okay, talking about protecting the nest from other sort of predatory birds or nuisance birds, I guess. Are there other predators that we need to be mindful of?
Snakes is probably the next thing. It's amazing. You wouldn't think a snake could climb a pole, but I've seen pictures that where a snake would actually climb up a rope. You know, and once they find that's an easy place to get food, they'll come back and wipe out the colony.
Okay.
And there's some people that's had colonies for years, and then just, well, all of a sudden, why didn't my martins come back the next year? They probably had predator problems.
Okay.
And if you don't check those nests at least once a week, you know, it's a good idea to any of your martin housing to be on a pole that raises and lowers so you can do your nest checks. And the nest checks are not only fun, but it, you know, like if I look at it at the beginning of the year, I'm looking for eggs. Once I see eggs, then I'll mark, you know, my houses, all my nest sites are numbered. I'll look, let's say nest site number 3, I saw 5 eggs. Well, the next week I want to see those 5 eggs again.
Okay.
And if I don't, then it may be, you know, if some of those eggs are missing, it may be a predator problem.
Mm-hmm.
If I had a round entrance, maybe a starling was getting in there. But it's the best thing you can do to your martin colony is just keep an eye on it. And that's fun. You know, you want to enjoy it.
Well, the assumption is, and I've read, that you want purple martins, besides being fun, that they eat a lot of insects. Is there any truth to that?
Yeah, they eat a lot of insects. There's a myth. They say that some people have been myth-led. But anyways, a lot of people have heard the term that they eat 2,000 mosquitoes a day.
Right.
And some scientific studies have been done, and they've, you know, one scientific study said that mosquitoes was less than 3% of their daily diet. So if you're getting into purple martins for mosquitoes, you might be getting in for the wrong reason. But using the colony at Ford Motor Company that I monitor, they put up martin housing to combat mosquito bites. They said that employees at work was getting bit by mosquitoes, and everybody at work that I've talked to that has been around those martins for a long time, they say that there's less mosquito bites. So I guess if you're in an area and there's just thousands of, you know, millions of mosquitoes, sure, they're going to eat some mosquitoes. But purple martins normally feed real high in the air.
Okay.
You know, about a couple
hundred
feet.
So other insects that are high in the air.
Yeah. Usually mosquitoes are out, you know, like, I guess early in the day and late in the day, but not in the middle of the day.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't fly real high up in the air. And like when I do nest checks, when the young are in the nest, I've seen big dragonflies. You know, a purple martin will grab a big insect. And I guess it would be like us humans, you know, if we were to go get something to eat, we'd rather get one large one plate time rather than...
They'll be well fed this year because the cicadas are coming back, so they'll have lots of cicadas to chew on.
Good.
Yeah, like housing, you hear about location, location, location. I've got a 3-acre pasture, but there's no water, and you're working at a Ford plant where you're getting purple martin. So where do you put the houses to best draw the birds?
The best place is the most wide open spot in your yard.
Okay.
You know, people are worried about trees. I started my colony about 20 foot from a small tree. Well, it started growing a little bit bigger and bigger, and then I learned more. The more I read, I found out that was the wrong spot, so I moved my colony. But anyways, the most wide open spot in your yard is the best place for martins. Now, if you got trees, it's not the end of, you know, you can still attract martins, but you need some wide open flyways.
Is water a necessity too?
It's good. I'd like to have a lake or a pond at my colony. I don't, you know, I'd like to have one because it's fun to watch them use the water.
Yeah.
Purple martins eat, bathe, and drink on the wing, and it's fun to watch them fly along the water and get water, along the lake and get water.
So it just makes for a more complete environment, but it's not necessary.
It's not necessary.
My colony, hear that.
My colony at home, I live about a 15-minute walk from Bernheim Forest, and they've got a nice big lake there, and I don't know this for sure, but I would think that my martins fly over there, and that's where their water source is.
So let's talk about housing. We've cited the location of the house, Bob, but what kind of house does the bird actually want? You brought, as I mentioned, some gourds in. The traditional sort of trio house, I think, is what they're called. I think we've got 3 of them up in the loft of the barn. You know, what are our options in terms of providing the right sort of apartment house for them or single family dwelling?
Well, if you live next door to somebody that had a real active martin colony, I'd probably put up what they had.
Okay.
Some of the landlords, you know, purple martins migrate as far north as parts of Canada. And some of the Martin housing up there are made of wood, and the wood is, you know, like 3/4 of an inch thick, and it provides warmth for the Martins, you know, when they return real early in the spring. But what seems to be a good trick for me in this part of Kentucky, Dad gave me the old trio house.
Mm-hmm.
They're the aluminum houses. They're mostly white. Some of them have some green trim on them. But Dad gave me this Martin house that we've had. I mean, it's been outside since the 70s, and it, you know, they pretty much last forever. But I think a good trick is to put natural gourds underneath one of those trio
okay.
houses. And, you know, there's several different choices you could make. That just is what happened to work for me. I had a trio house and hung 2 natural gourds under it, and luckily the first year I had a few pair of Martins.
So, and the gourds that you brought in are white. Does white actually provide some sort of benefit in terms of attracting them?
Well, white, they're probably used to seeing the white gourds.
Okay.
And white also reflects heat
it.
Is probably the main reason
okay.
landlords paint their houses white.
Landlords.
Uh-huh. We are landlords.
You
we
are.
Provide,
That's
we provide
great.
Housing for Purple Martin.
Well, yeah, to that end, Larry, one thing I'm learning today for sure is that it's like gardening. It's going to take 1 year, 2 year, 3 years, patience, and a little bit of work to get it right. You just can't put the house out there, not get Purple Martins, and quit.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's, you know, it's a trial and error type deal. Over at Bernheim Forest, we've got a colony that we're trying to start, and we wanted it close to a building where there was a lot of human traffic, but it hasn't worked. So sometimes if you really want Purple Martins and you're not getting them for the first or second year, you know, you may want to consider moving your housing. You know, mm-hmm. you might not have it just in the right spot, but they like wide open flyways, and even if you have a few trees in your yard, that's not the end of the world. You could still have an open area, like let's say if you had trees on one corner of your lot and a mm-hmm. wide open field, well, then Martins will take off towards that field. And the reason they don't like the trees is because that's a place where hawks could hide.
Oh.
Okay.
You know, if you have real tall trees, hawks can hide real high in the tree, and boy, they shoot down like bullets before the Martins see them, and, you know.
Can you rent Purple Martins just for the summer?
I'd make some money if I could send some Martins. I've had plenty of people ask me that one.
Hurts rent a Martin.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Okay, so how high should the house be?
10 to 15 feet is what
okay.
I read.
Mm-hmm.
Just using my colony at home for an example, I'm not up on a real high hill, but my lot drops off, and my gourds, I can probably just about touch the bottom of my gourds. They're probably about 9 feet on my lowest house. So I think if you were in an area and you had trees, you'd probably want to lean towards the taller. You'd want your housing taller so that you could probably attract Martins and they wouldn't have to worry about the hawks attacking. But
okay.
But if you're in a big, wide open area, you know,
it doesn't have to be that
tall.
Okay.
Now, you've had some success, and yet every year do you have to fight off the starlings again, or by now are they established enough that the birds just take over when they come in?
It's a constant battle.
Is it really?
Them starlings, they've been introduced. You know, they're a non-native
right.
species, and you can ask bluebird people. You know, you can pick up a book somewhere, and I guarantee you, if you pick up a good book on Purple Martins or bluebirds, there'll be a spot in there about controlling starlings and
right.
house sparrows. The house mm-hmm. sparrows, you got to be careful because there's so many good sparrows out there. You want to be real good on your ID,
right.
correctly ID them. But the European starlings, this time of year when my Martins come back, it's sometimes almost an aggravation. But with the starling-resistant entrance hole, that's made my job that much easier because
mm-hmm.
starlings can still possibly get in them, but not as easy as the 2-inch holes. And then you're only fighting half of them, the house sparrows, because the house sparrows can get in those starling-resistant entrances.
So where do you get those little inserts?
You can make them. You can,
okay.
The Purple Martin Conservation Association, they have a website.
Okay, and you can get them through there.
Uh-huh.
Okay, we'll provide all that information on our website as well.
Uh-huh.
And then how long do you have to fight the battle? Is it all summer, or eventually do the Purple Martins take over and starlings go away?
Once you have a good colony of Martins, they'll help you fight the battle to some extent. But what's very aggravating about the starlings is the fact that I wouldn't have a problem with them if they would just beat the Purple Martins to the nest. But once you lower the nest, I've seen this, I've read it, they'll actually go in there and take the baby birds and toss them out and steal the nest. And, you know, they'll sometimes, you know, if a Purple Martin male or female, you know, the adult bird is trying to protect the nest, the starlings are more powerful.
And
they've got
aggressive.
Uh-huh. They've got needle point-shaped beak, and they'll actually kill them and throw them out and steal the nest. And once you see that,
it makes it a lot easier to get
the
starlings.
My
Nina, my grandmother, used to say, "Ish kaka," to those nasty birds. She hated starlings.
Yeah.
And she loved all the other birds, of course. Tell us a little bit about the purple martins that you've actually trained.
Well, that's something else that I read that people won't believe. But you don't have to, but purple martins, they come back so early. The oldest birds, what some people call scouts, they'll come back so early because starlings are starting to look for nests, and I guess over time. But anyways, they come back too early, and if we have a cold weather pattern that reduces insect flight, then purple martins doesn't have anything to eat for 4 or 5 days, however long the cold weather lasts.
Okay.
You know, probably a general rule of thumb that a lot of the landlords talk about is if it's 50 degrees or higher, you know, on real windy days or rainy days, it reduces insect flight. But anyways, what I've done, I've trained my purple martins to accept crickets. And you toss them up in the air, and they won't learn how to accept food from you unless they're hungry. But I read about this, and I trained my martins 2 or 3 years ago, and I bought a bunch of crickets from the bait store, and I took a plastic a long plastic spoon, and I put these crickets in the refrigerator for about 10 minutes in the freezer so that they quit wiggling so they won't jump off the spoon.
Oh, okay.
But anyways,
still alive, just a little flash frozen.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
And some people freeze them all the way and then let them warm up. But I like to see my crickets wiggle a little bit. And I think it may help, you know, if a purple martin sees I think they would take more to a live cricket rather than a dead one.
Okay, so you put them on the spoon.
Uh-huh.
Flash frozen.
Uh-huh. And you shoot them up in the air past them. And I do this early in the spring. You know, when I trained mine the first time, I bet I shot 40 or 50 crickets, and I just about gave up. Well, I think I did that day. And the next day I went out there, I thought, I'm going to try it again, because you could just see the martins. Their wings were kind of drooping, and you can tell they were
hungry.
Yeah, they were hungry. And I had read about it that you could do it. So anyways, I kept shooting the crickets just right past them. You know, I didn't want to hit them, but I wanted to make sure they'd see it. And it's funny. You could see the martins. They'd look at it, and they'd see it come by. But it's weird for them because they're not used to
food
being
thrown at them.
Especially shot up from the ground. They're just not used to that.
Here, Martin.
Once that first bird catches it, and
it was
every one of them caught it.
Oh,
and,
great.
And it's really, it makes you feel good now. You know, this year, I'll have my crickets out, and I feed them at my driveway, and they're literally flying over my shoulder. And, but, a couple years ago, I found some dead martins. You know, and it was after a cold spell, and I've read that purple martins can literally starve to death if it gets too cold for too long. And
so there was some necessity in it as well.
Well, Larry, it's a marvelous thing you're doing. This was just fun to talk to you.
Well, I'm so glad that y'all gave me the opportunity. Purple martins need more humans to put up nest sites for them. East of the Rocky Mountains, they almost entirely depend on human-supplied nest sites.
Well, I think you've recruited two more people.
Great. Right. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much. We appreciate it. Larry Melcher is a purple martin landlord. I like that term. He takes care of about 150 purple martin nests around town, including the public colony of Bernheim, where visitors can learn more about how to attract these fabulous birds. Larry conducts workshops at the Arboretum as well, so check their calendar. For more information about purple martins and to see the images of Larry Melcher's purple martins, please see our website at WFPL.org.
Coming up next, a few listener questions and another chapter in Bob's Fabulous Plant Stories. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Bob Hill.
And Janine Wishy.
With a quality question for some quality answers.
Yes, we do have a question from Miss Barbara Carter. She said that they recently purchased some acreage in Meade County, Vine Grove area, and the backside of it is Otter Creek. How lucky they are, huh?
Yeah.
About 3 acres of this land is forested with walnut, poplar, buckeye, etc. But she said that there's some horrific stormwater flooding on the forested side. So she was wondering if we had any suggestions in terms of ground covers or shrubs, that sort of thing, that can help hold in the soil because there's some erosion problems that they're experiencing. I'm sure she really is, especially with all the rain that we've had this season. So any suggestions from us? You got
I'm
any?
Using one of my, in the Bob Bog, go figure, called Acorus, A-C-O-R-U-S.
Mm-hmm.
It loves water. It spreads really well. It's got a nice thick root and it's doing well so far. Now, it was 4 feet underwater the spring, so I'm not sure if it can breathe underwater or not, but it looked good. When water went down, it looked fine.
So Acorus, A-C-O-R-U-S.
Yes, yeah.
Okay. And of course, the carexes, the sedges, the reeds, all those things are considered good wetland plants, and they root out. You know, I wouldn't plant them now while we're having so much rain because the plants probably will wash away.
Yeah.
But get them established during a more gentle time, and and they'll hold the soil in.
The tricky part is when it dries or there's a drought, they've got to survive that too. So you got to be careful. You just don't want a pure water plant. You need something that's adaptable.
Yeah, and the carexes, I think, do a really good job. Those are the sedges and such. Buttonbush. Buttonbush is a great wetland plant.
Yeah, it's got cool buttons on it, too.
It does. That's a very good choice, I think. And, I mean, she might consider planting some more sycamores or something like that along the water's edge. Sycamores like water, beautiful trees. That's the kind of place they like to be, I would suspect. Beautiful white mottled bark, you know.
I love them. Yeah, they're a nice plane tree or sycamore tree. And even some willows. There's some lower growing willows. Now, they'll run like crazy. She might want that there. So there's some possibilities.
Yeah, possibilities. So, yeah, I'd, you know, concentrate on those that qualify as wetland plants. How's that?
Yeah, if you have a wet or dryland plant for Bob or Janine, visit the homegrown page at WFPL.org. Email us at homegrown@WFPL.org. Or call us at 502-814-8246.
Right, Bob, it's a plant story day. What do you have for us?
Another plant with a lousy name.
Oh, great.
Echinacea.
Oh, I love that name.
You do?
Yes.
I just wish it was more, I don't like commercial things either. Maybe I'm being hasty here.
It's prickly.
Yeah. It's also called echinacea, but echinacea, I think, is the proper
pronunciation. I've heard people say echinacea.
Yeah, and it's also called, of course, the purple coneflower. It sounds like a disease of some sort. I mean, how you feeling, Bob? I've got purple coneflower here. But believe it or not, the great name came from the Greek echinos for hedgehog or porcupine.
Prickly.
Yeah, you probably knew that, or prickly, It's got that spiny central disc in the middle. I like that. I really do.
I do, too.
It's a North American native, almost controversial because of the herbal use of it. It just spread across the world. I went on Google to check into it, and there's 3.8 million Google hit sites
for echinacea, and it's
of which 3.7 million is trying to sell some herbs.
So,
but the truth is, the various Native American tribes, as you know, it's what you teach, used it for toothaches, sore throat, mumps, and smallpox. Guess who brought that to them? Also insect bites, wounds, burns, sore necks, and headaches. So it was kind of an all-purpose drug for the Native Americans. Inevitably got into the Western Medicine Man show, and the word spread from there that it was good for herbal relief and herbal medicine. Led to a multi-billion dollar industry used by tens of millions of people around the world. It still is, in fact, for treating the flu, colds, things like that.
It helps your immune system,
I think
is the claim.
The killjoys at the New England Journal of Medicine did a study in 2005 with 437 people who volunteered to have cold viruses dripped in their nose. I know. How much would you pay for that? It didn't work.
Okay.
It didn't do any better than the placebo. It just wasn't worth it.
Yeah.
Just the power of folklore, myth, and word of mouth. It's still being used as an herbal medicine. But it's still good in the garden. I'm sure you grow it at the Wishy Estate. It's not a long-lived plant. It takes 3, 4, 5 years. It likes heat, dry soil, full sun. But they grow from 18 inches to 5 feet tall. It's kind of a cool plant.
There's some fabulous echinaceas out there.
And there's some new colors coming, of course. There's rose and creamy white and orange and gold. And then there's my favorite one is a dwarf one called Kim's Knee-High. Comes in yellow, pink, purple. The purple coneflower, of course, is the most common, the Magnus. It's been around for a long, long time. So it's the purple coneflower, the echinacea, and it comes with a poem. Who could have believed such medical power produced from the loins of the purple coneflower? Bed bites and gout, the flu and sore trachea, all put to death by the proud echinacea. A curative plant from our great medical fog, yet named for, go figure, the lowly hedgehog. Then groomed for the salvation of all kith and kin, while surviving the wrath of the gods of medicine. Creating some mystery of this I'll be verbal, is it a plant or something more herbal? The question becomes, dear listeners, please vote. Does it go in your yard or is it shoved down your throat?
Maybe a little bit of both.
The echinacea.
Very nice.
Threaterminus.
Fabulous plant, any way you look at it, I think.
Yeah, it is.
So thank you, Bob. That ends another edition of Homegrown. We hope that you join us next week, of course.
Homegrown is produced by the always color-coordinated Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.